I don't eat bananas very often anymore. To be honest, I'm not very excited by bananas, although when I was a kid, I used to love them. It could just be that my tastes have changed over the years, but I always used to put it down to something else. I believed that bananas used to be better, that the banana of my childhood was somehow sweeter and tastier than bland modern varieties. For most of my adult life, I've taken bananas for granted. But 10 years ago, I read an article in The New Yorker by Mike Peed suggesting that the banana pandemic that had been spreading across Asia since 1989 could wipe out the banana as we know it. A decade on, that pandemic continues. The disease reached Latin America in 2015. There are still bananas in the shops. But for how long? That thing about bananas tasting better in my childhood, it isn't true. There are many varieties of banana in the world, but chances are you and I have only ever tasted one kind. The Cavendish. Those bananas in the supermarket, they're all Cavendish, all the time. The big ones are Cavendish, the small ones are Cavendish, the fair trade and organic ones, Cavendish. This makes for a very consistent product, but it also leaves bananas across the globe very susceptible to disease. I asked James Dale, Professor of Agricultural Biology at the University of Queensland, to begin at the very beginning.
Just to start, and this might like seem like a very basic question, but what is a banana exactly?
Well, so I could give you a whole lot of answers to that. It's one of the top 10 food crops in the world, rates round about number 6. It's a tropical and subtropical fruit crop, particularly in the wet tropics and subtropics. It's actually known as a giant herb. It's a monocot. So, you know, the monocots are things like grasses, lilies, etc. So it's a monocot. It's a giant herb. Originates from Southeast Asia, right across to South Asia, and in fact, right down to the tip of Australia.
So it's, I know it's not a tree, a banana tree, is it? Doesn't have a trunk per se.
That's right. Yeah. So it's called a pseudostem, the bit that holds the plant up, and that's made up of the petioles of the leaves. So the leaves grow up. The growing point is right down in the base, in the corm, and it puts out these leaves, and the leaves together make up, or the petioles of the leaves make the pseudostem. And then the leaves come out the top.
Bananas are the world's most popular fruit. 114 million metric tons are produced each year. But about 85% of those are consumed locally, generally within 5 or 10 kilometers of where they're grown. And they come in many different varieties. The other 15% of bananas are exported to Europe, North America, Russia, Japan. And they only come in one kind.
So the export banana is purely Cavendish bananas. Probably 99.9% is just one type of banana, Cavendish. However, Cavendish accounts for around about 50% of the bananas grown in the world. It's a lovely story about how Cavendish was moved from Asia over to Central and South America and became the world's dominant banana.
To tell the story of the Cavendish, we have Dr. Chris Cockle from the Millennium Seed Bank Partnership at Royal Botanical Gardens, Kew.
So the Cavendish banana is named after William Cavendish, who was the Duke of Devonshire. And he apparently received a shipment of bananas from Mauritius in 1834. And it was his head gardener who cultivated these bananas in the glasshouses at Chatsworth House. And that was how that variety of banana was produced.
And the date you said
1834.
Now, the Cavendish didn't become the main banana that everyone eats until like the 1940s, 1950s, because something happened.
Cavendish's name was given to this banana. It was presumably domesticated or cultivated by somebody in Mauritius before that. And it wasn't really in widespread commercial cultivation until, well, it wasn't in commercial cultivation until the beginning of the 20th century. And it was only when its predecessor, the Gros Michel, ran into difficulties in the 1950s that then they had to madly search around for a replacement when the commercial market for the Gros Michel collapsed.
What happened, my understanding, is that the Gros Michel succumbed to a fungal infection that sort of basically wiped out the crop, or was on the verge of wiping out the crop?
So the Gros Michel, yeah, also known as the Big Mike. that was the main banana that people would have eaten up until the 1950s. And this so-called Panama disease, which has been banana wilt, and it was the first strain of that, the first identified strain of this banana wilt called TR1 that affected the Gros Michel. And as you say, it basically wiped out the commercial value of the crop. And so the Gros Michel is still around, but only on fairly small-scale production.
Before the Cavendish, the Gros Michel was the top banana, the dominant monoculture. When someone eats a banana in a silent film or slips on a skin, it's a Gros Michel. By all accounts, the Gros Michel is a fantastic banana, sweet and incredibly robust. And it was more banana-y than the Cavendish, containing a higher concentration of isoamyl acetate, the chemical they isolate to make artificial banana flavoring. If you've ever tasted a banana sweet, that taste is based on the Gros Michel. If you're old enough, older than me, you really do remember a time when bananas were better.
The motto, a Long Island potato, but yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
That's what this song, Yes, We Have No Bananas, written by Frank Silver and Irving Cohn in 1923, refers to. The first reference to the original Panama disease we found is from April 1912 in the Boston Globe, by which time the disease had already spread through Central America to Trinidad and Jamaica. The article states that no expense will be spared in fighting the disease, a fight that 40 years later was already lost. One quick tangent on this song. It was sung at the outdoor relief protests in Belfast in 1932 because it was the only non-sectarian song that both Catholic and Protestant communities in Northern Ireland knew the words to.
Dark brown and ball bearing, but yet we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
And the Cavendish became the replacement because it was resistant.
At first it seemed like it was resistant. I believe that it was possible to plant Cavendish plants to replace Gros Michel plants that had died, and so it seemed to be resistant. In the decades since then, a new strain of this Panama wilt has been identified. Now it's called TR4, first identified in Taiwan in the late 1980s, and that is now affecting Cavendish bananas.
So here we are in the 21st century, and history is repeating itself. The Cavendish banana, which accounts for 95% of commercially sold bananas and 100% of the ones you find in the UK and Europe, could be heading for the same fate as the Gros Michel, thanks to the tropical race 4 strain of the fungus.
The official name is Fusarium oxysporum, Forma specialis cubensi. And then it's got another little bit at the end, which is the race. And so it's tropical race 4. So it's Fusarium oxysporum, Forma specialis cubensi, tropical race 4. We can call it FOC, much easier to remember. So FOC, there was one very famous race 1, which in the first half of last century wiped out the then export banana, which was Gros Michel. And that's why the world took on Cavendish, because Cavendish was resistant to race 1.
The fungus, how does it attack the plant?
Well, it lives in the soil. Almost certainly the fungus evolved in Southeast Asia, where bananas evolved. So, and that's that's pretty standard stuff. You know, the pathogens and the crop tend to evolve together, and when you move them around, you've got problems. So it lives in the soil. It can live in the soil for very, very long periods of time without bananas being grown, so at least 50 years. And then what it does is when bananas come along, they say, wow, look at this. Oh, it's a fabulous food source. And they send out little hyphae that then infect the roots. And they go in, they get in through the usually in wounds in the roots, and then they get up into the vascular system of the plant. And what they do, fusarium is sort of a characteristic of this particular type of fungus, is they kill the tissue. So they live primarily on dead tissue. They might live a little bit on living tissue, but they're primarily like dead tissue. And so when they get in, they kill the tissue, and then they grow really well on that dead tissue. And, of course, when the tissue dies, particularly that's the vascular system, the plant collapses, and so you get this wilt type symptoms.
And I guess the problem with the threat from one single fungus is that, as you said before, we're primarily growing one single kind of banana. They're clones.
They're exactly right. They're not all identical. Everyone says, "Oh, well, you know, Cavendish is identical." No, it's not. Cavendish probably emerged around about 1,000 years ago. Cavendish is probably at least 1,000 years old when that particular wonderful genetic event happened that created Cavendish, and probably Gros-Michel in a similar time period. And there are variants. So, you know, there's a whole lot of different types of Cavendish which are quite distinct. Like there's dwarf Cavendish. In Australia, we grow dwarf Cavendish. We grow primarily a selection that came from Australia called Williams. Grand Nain is one of the favourite ones around the world. Valerie. So there are a whole lot of different variants, and they've obviously picked up mutations as they've gone along over the last 1,000 years. So they're not all identical.
Right. So they're cloned by taking the suckers from the base of the plant.
That's right.
And replanting those?
That's right.
But
yes.
It's random genetic mutation that leads to these differences, even though they're not cross-pollinated with anything.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. Known as somatic mutations rather than embryonic mutations. So, yeah, and they accumulate over time.
And the problem with breeding a resistant variety is that Cavendish bananas don't have any seeds.
No, they don't. They're essentially sterile. They produce pollen, but they, you know, if you cut a Cavendish banana down the middle, you sometimes see little black specks, and they're actually the aborted seeds. So it's a triploid. So it's got three copies of its genome. You and I have two. Bananas have, or the vast majority of bananas have three, and that probably is one of the reasons why they're sterile. And being sterile is one of the reasons why they're incredibly successful as a fruit. If you go in, you can go into the wild and you can find diploid bananas, which are seeded. And we've got some in Australia. They're right up through Southeast Asia. Those seeds, and the fruit is absolutely packed with seed, and the seeds are like little pebbles. No one would ever.
Right.
Yeah. You're hard to get a meal out of. You're hard to get a mouthful out of a fruit after you've scraped off all the seeds. So the reason they've become so popular is that, you know, 1,000 years ago, Cavendish came along and it was obviously a mutation of some sort, and it was a triploid, and it didn't have any seed. And people really enjoyed the fruit, and it's been propagated ever since. And a lot of other bananas are the same.
And I guess it is possible to get a seed out of a Cavendish, isn't it, through?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. There was a great colleague of mine, a guy who unfortunately died a number of years ago, a guy called Phil Rowe, who was one of the original plant breeders. He was based in Honduras. And he would, and luckily had a number of workers who would go and do this sort of thing, would go out and and deliberately fertilize. You take pollen from a diploid banana, so that fertile banana, and go and deliberately pollinate maybe a hectare of banana flowers. He'd then go and collect all the fruit and, you know, squeeze all the seeds out of them, and he would get 3 or 4 seeds per hectare. An incredibly small number. So it's a very rare event.
Although it's slow, painstaking, and often thankless, it is possible to germinate banana seeds, and some people are making the effort. Here's Chris Cockle again.
I mean, with traditional crop breeding, you grow out the wild relatives, and then you characterize the plants for various traits, so you can test them to see whether they're resistant to heat or drought stress and things like that. I mean, it still takes a long time. It still takes 10 or 15 years, I understand, to breed new wheat or rice variety. But in bananas, the main problem is with using, obviously, you need to grow the plant until it gets to maturity and produces flowers. I mean, we've had plants at the Millennium Seed Bank, which from 2016, and they're now bursting out of the roof, but they still haven't produced flowers, and that's 5 years on. But as I said, germinating the seeds is difficult. With cereals, you can usually get 99% germination if you're working with good seeds. Bananas are difficult to germinate, and we've been working with our colleagues at the International Banana Transit Center in Belgium to try and improve banana germination. And we actually had a PhD student working with us who got pretty good at germinating banana seeds on using sand rather than, as we usually do it, on agar. So going from around 20% germination to 50 or 60% germination. And then we actually produced more plants than we knew what to do with. We had 77 banana plants that I thought, well, they're really good plants to tell the story of crop wild relatives, and people like bananas. So I ended up sending banana plants all over the place to the Eden Project and to Cambridge Botanic Gardens, etc. So now plants from the project are distributed around the UK.
So far, nobody has been able to produce the next export banana through traditional breeding. But James Dale, who spent the last 30 years working to save the banana, says he has the solution. He'll tell us what it is after this short break. Today's episode of Insult My Intelligence is sponsored by One Day University. One Day University is a subscription platform giving you access to live talks by the best professors from the top US colleges on a wide range of topics. Membership includes a new live-streamed lecture every weekday with a Q&A with the professor afterwards, along with access to a library of more than 500 talks from over 200 top-rated lecturers. Some of those talks include 4 Films That Changed America by Mark Lapidula of Yale University, Learning from the Roman Empire, Are We Repeating Their Rise and Decline from Caroline Winterer of Stanford University, and The Women Who Ruled the World 3,500 Years Ago from Kara Cooney of UCLA. You can learn something new every day about history, politics, art, science, music, psychology, and much more. You can sign up for $8.95 a month or $89 a year at onedayu.com/insultmyintelligence. And for our listeners, if you sign up now, you get a 2-week free trial and half price for the first year with coupon code PODCAST. So sign up now at onedayu.com/insultmyintelligence and use coupon code PODCAST for half off your first year.
Your solution is genetic modification.
Genetic modification and also gene editing.
Right.
So we've taken the attitude, and it's not only to do with Cavendish, is that nature has actually presented us with 300 or 400, maybe 1,000 different types of edible bananas. They all have problems of one sort. Cavendish's problem is that it's susceptible to tropical race 4. It's also susceptible to black sigatoka. You can go through nearly every banana and they've got a problem. Our idea is, why not fix the problem? So rather than trying to outsmart nature, and nature's pretty bloody good at turning out good things, Why don't we just tweak what we've already got to make it not the perfect fruit? We'll never get to that. But to at least make it disease resistant in the first instance, or to make it more transportable, or to increase the yield. And so those are the things that we're starting to be able to do. So we've already generated Cavendish bananas by genetic modification that appear to be completely immune to tropical race 4. We've taken those through 6 years of field trials. So it's possible to do that. Now what we're trying to do is to do the same thing. Believe it or not, there is some opposition to genetically modified fruit. So we're now using a technology called gene editing, which is essentially going in and just tweaking the genes that are already in Cavendish bananas in this instance.
Right. Okay. there's no point in me pretending I understand the difference.
Well, let me just try to summarize the difference. The difference with genetic modification is in nearly all instances adding a new bit of DNA.
From somewhere else.
Not necessarily from somewhere else. So our bananas that we've created that are highly resistant, nearly immune, we've used a banana gene. We've taken a gene from a resistant banana and put it into Cavendish.
Yeah, okay. So it's not like a gene from an owl or something.
That's it. Exactly right. You know, we're much more sophisticated than we were 20 years ago. Yeah, you know, we're starting to do things a little bit more, a little bit smarter than we used to. So that's genetic modification, adding a new bit of DNA. Gene editing essentially is saying, okay, what we're going to do is go into the banana genome in this case and just alter the genes that are already there and alter them very subtly. And the sort of alterations we can do are the sort of alterations that happen naturally anyway. So that's really the big difference between the two technologies.
And the main difference from a global export point of view is that the resistance to genetically modified organisms is huge. It's illegal in the EU, isn't it?
It's not illegal. The EU imports huge amounts of genetically modified soybean and corn every year to feed their animals. Right. And there are some countries in the EU that actually grow genetically modified corn. So it's not illegal. It's just that the processes to go through to try to get something deregulated in EU is massive and unlikely to be successful.
Right.
That's the big problem.
There's a lot of consumer resistance generally, isn't there, as well?
There is. Yes, there is, yes.
And does gene editing get around that?
So in many instances, in Australia, in North America, a number of countries in South America, in Japan, and increasingly other countries are now saying the simplest forms of gene editing are not considered genetic modification and will not be labelled.
Okay.
So that's the thing. The EU and New Zealand, of course, have gone in the other direction and have said, yep, no, editing is just the same as genetic modification. They're starting to rue. They're jumping the gun on that bit because there's a lot of discussion now that maybe they're going to have to wind some of that resistance back. And particularly in the UK, you know, there's a lot of discussion about gene editing actually being a non-GM technology.
Right. And in any case, a lot of the fears that people have about genetically modified organisms don't really apply to the banana, do they?
No, they don't. So, there's all sorts of, obviously I've been challenged by large numbers of anti-GM groups over the years because I've been working on GM bananas for a long time. Because bananas are sterile, the sorts of bananas we deal with are sterile, there's no gene flow. There's no movement of these transgenes that we put in. They won't move to another banana. So they're stable within the banana. So there's none of that environmental concern about, as they call it, genetic contamination. It's not that at all. It's just genetic movement, obviously. But that doesn't happen in bananas. I could grow a non-GM banana next to a GM banana, maybe a meter difference, and the genes will not move. So from that perspective, they're very tough. And in our instance, we're using banana genes. So people are consuming these genes anyway. How it's been an interesting experiment group experiment. Because when we talk to people who remember Gros Michel, and a lot of that memory I suspect is read about rather than actual. Yeah, this wonderful banana, and wouldn't it be wonderful to bring Gros Michel back. We grow some up in North Queensland because we need to get the banana flowers to start off our own process. The guy that grows them, he says, these are the worst bananas in the world. They're far too tall. I'd never grow them commercially. The bunches aren't big enough. And the yield probably isn't as good as Cavendish. I suspect that, okay, we're doing it because we think it's important to create a much greater level of biodiversity. But maybe when those two things come on the market, people will say, well, I think I'll buy the Cavendish because it's a bit cheaper.
Creating a tropical race 4 resistant Cavendish banana has not been James Dale's only banana project. His other banana work is life-saving and won him Queensland's Senior Australian of the Year in 2019.
You mentioned your super vitamin A banana, yeah, which we wanted to ask you about. How did that project come about?
It came about, we were already working with colleagues in Uganda. Uganda, the staple food in Uganda is bananas. So it's cooking bananas. They're not plantains, they're bananas. They're cooking bananas. And the level of consumption is just, you know, amazing. So across the entire country, it's estimated that it's around about half a kilo per person per day. So that's everybody. In some areas, it's over a kilo per person per day. So it's their primary starch source. But like all developing countries where there's a staple food which is relatively easily available, relatively cheap, nearly all of those staple foods are low in micronutrients. And so you get vitamin A deficiency, you get iron deficiency, anemia, et cetera. We've always had really good strategies to overcome that, and that's been things like supplements, vitamin A supplements or fortification of food. They're terrific as long as you have the infrastructure in place to be able to provide those things. And two things have been happening over the last probably 20 years. A certain amount of donor fatigue, because these things require, those strategies require inputs every year. So there's a sort of donor fatigue, but also you're getting isolated communities. You know, we're talking really the poorest of the poor. So Bill Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates, it would have been about 2003, came up with the idea of what they call grand challenges in global health. And one of those grand challenges was to biofortify staple foods. So vitamin A and iron were the major ones. So we were already working in Uganda, and we with our collaborators there put in for a Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation project under this Grand Challenges of Global Health. And amazingly, we were successful in getting that funding. That was back in 2005. And that project has been incredibly successful. The Gates Foundation have supported us, and they still do. So we're now talking 16 years, and that's how long it takes to develop these crops. We're now in multi-location field trials in Uganda. We've got our collaborators there are still running those trials despite all of the problems with COVID-19. And we're very close to being able to release a banana which has very, very high levels of provitamin A.
Is this process the same genetically as the disease-resistant Cavendish?
It is, to the point it's genetic modification, and it is because we've used a banana gene. There are bananas that are, and I keep talking about provitamin A. So provitamin A is alpha and beta carotene, and that's converted by the human body, it's converted in the liver to retinol, the vitamin A. The wonderful thing about that is it doesn't matter how much beta carotene you have, it even goes slightly orange if necessary, the body only converts the amount that it needs. And so this was quite important, because when we started out, we could have actually produced bananas with vitamin A in them, but very high levels of vitamin A can be toxic. So we said we have no control over how many bananas people are going to eat in Uganda. You know, they won't have a huge festival and eat a huge amount of bananas. The last thing we want is toxicity. So we put in the genes for enhancing high levels of alpha and beta carotene. So we don't have to be concerned about overdosing. So that's been amazingly successful.
Are these bananas a different color?
Yeah, they are. The flesh is orange because beta carotene is orange. I should have gone back and said, okay, the gene that we got actually comes out of a banana that is naturally has very high levels of beta carotene. So again, it's a moving a banana gene from one banana to another.
Right. I mean, it's a way of hastening breeding processes, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. Yeah. But because the bananas we're dealing with are sterile, we can't breed them. So the best way to move that gene around is through modification.
In the meantime, the threat to the Cavendish banana continues. This year, Tropical Race 4 was found in Peru and Venezuela, two of the world's largest banana exporters. Biosecurity measures aimed at containing TR4 aren't working, and the industry is facing up to the possibility of shortages, sharp price rises, or worse, the catastrophic failure of the worldwide Cavendish crop. A banana apocalypse. Bananageddon.
I have one final question. Is it possible that we could lose this race and end up with supermarkets that have no bananas in them?
I don't think so. No. I'm very positive. I think despite all of us being in a competition to produce the next big banana, I've got colleagues who are beavering away while I'm wasting time sitting around in front of the fire this evening. That they're going to produce really good bananas. We're producing, I think, really good bananas. We have a solution already. It's genetically modified. Okay. If the supermarkets had a choice of no Cavendish or a genetically modified Cavendish, I think people would start to buy those. However, I think gene-edited ones will be more acceptable, and they should be rolled out in 4 to 5 years. And then there will be the different types of bananas which are coming out of the conventional breeding programs. So I'm very confident that in 5 years' time there'll be just as many bananas in supermarkets and smaller shops as there are today.
I actually had one more question to ask him. Of all people, James Dale must have tried a Gros Michel. And I wanted to know, how much better is it?
So I've tasted Gros Michel, depending where they're grown. So if they grow at high altitude, they do taste pretty good. So we do a lot of work in Uganda, and the Ugandans, of their dessert bananas, one of their favourites is Gros Michel. You hardly see Cavendish anywhere. So we get Gros Michel in Uganda, and it's a really good banana. It doesn't taste that much better than Cavendish, but maybe marginally better. Unless you do a lot of taste tests, you're not gonna pick up too many people who can pick the difference.
All right, okay. So it's not something we're all missing.
No, I wouldn't lose any sleep about it.
Okay, I'll stop.
There's a fruit store on our
Thanks for listening to Insult My Intelligence, hosted by me, Tim Dowling, and produced, as always, by Johnny Dowling. Thanks to my guests, James Dale and Chris Cockle. You can follow us on Twitter at InsultMyIntel, and if you have an idea or a topic for an episode, email us at InsultMyIntelShow@gmail.com or visit our website, InsultMyIntelShow.com. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening. We'll be back in a fortnight with a new episode about balls. Specifically, cricket balls. Tomato, a Long Island potato, but yes, we have no bananas, we have no bananas today.